Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict urges aid for the victims of a grave humanitarian crisis in northern Nigeria, where floods have forced 2 million people to flee their homes. 50 years of nationhood. Nigeria marks the golden jubilee of its independence from Britain on Wednesday. But is there a lot to celebrate? We find out more from the Archbishop of Abuja. Pakistan's continuing plight. The waters may have receded in many areas after the devastating floods in Pakistan, but the humanitarian emergency is still huge, as we learn from a Catholic aid worker who recently returned from there. And solar storm scare. Scientists have warned that massive solar flares in 2013 could cause global chaos by triggering power cuts and a breakdown in communications. But how real is this threat? We investigate with the help of an astronomer at the Vatican Observatory. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict has appealed for aid for the victims of severe flooding in northern Nigeria that has forced over 2 million people to flee their homes. His appeal came during his Wednesday general audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Speaking to a crowd of an estimated 20,000 this Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI launched an appeal for victims of severe flooding in northern Nigeria.
My thoughts also turn to the grave humanitarian crisis which has struck northern Nigeria, where some 2 million people have been forced to flee their homes because of severe flooding. To all those affected, I express my spiritual closeness and I assure them of my prayers.
Earlier in the general catechesis during the audience, Pope Benedict XVI returned to his series of lessons on the great women figures of the Church in the Middle Ages. Once again, the figure the Pope chose to highlight was a nun, a mystic, and German, Saint Mathilde von Hackenborn, who was also known to her contemporaries in the 13th century as God's Nightingale.
Dear brothers and sisters, in our catechesis today, we focus on the life of St. Matilda of Hackeborn, one of several important 13th century figures of the convent of Helfta in Saxony. Entering there at an early age, Matilda was formed in an intense spiritual and intellectual atmosphere, founded upon sacred scripture, the liturgy, and the patristic tradition. This climate, along with the gift of divine illumination that she received through her mystical contemplation, enabled her to compose numerous prayers and be of counsel and consolation to many.
Distinguished by her humility and intelligence, and by the intensity with which she lived her relationship with God and the saints, Matilda became the director of the convent's novices, its choirs, and its school.
In this way, she also became the spiritual guide of St. Gertrude the Great, and also an important figure of Germanic monasticism. Dear friends, St. Matilda's life of prayer, guided by sacred scripture and nourished by the Holy Eucharist, led her to an intimate union with Christ, expressed in her devotion to his Sacred Heart.
In comments in Italian, the Pope added that St. Matilda followed a path of intimate union with the Lord, always in full fidelity to the Church. He said, "This is also a strong call for us to strengthen our friendship with the Lord, especially through daily prayer and careful, faithful, and active participation in Mass."
May we too grow in the devotion through the power of her intercession. Upon all the English-speaking visitors present to this audience, especially the pilgrim groups from Britain, Ireland, Denmark, Nigeria, Oceania, the Philippines, and North America, I invoke God's abundant blessings. Thank you.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
It's Africa's most populous nation and is the continent's largest oil producer and exporter. But as Nigeria marks the 50th anniversary of its independence from Britain on Wednesday, the question often been asked is, how much is there to celebrate on this golden jubilee? The nation is currently grappling with severe flooding and is in a political vacuum ahead of scheduled elections early in 2011. What's more, looking back over the past half century, Nigeria has seen a devastating civil war, numerous military coups, and periodic outbreaks of sectarian violence. Although rich in natural resources, especially oil, millions of Nigerians are still mired in poverty and go hungry, a problem blamed by many on poor governance and widespread corruption. So, what is the current mood of Nigerians on this 50th anniversary? What are the nation's main successes and failures over the past half century? And what are the most pressing challenges for the future? To find out more, I turn to one of the country's leading churchmen, Archbishop John Onayekin of Abuja, for his assessment.
The mood in Nigeria is not so clear. The official line of the government, of course, is upbeat, and we are celebrating Golden Jubilee, 50 years of independence, and all the wonderful things we have achieved. But on the other hand, you hear a lot from the ordinary people on the streets, especially the youths, who are asking, what is there to celebrate? Things are not going well. We should be the giant Africa, and we can't even have steady electricity, and even the telephone lines are all dead. We can only phone by cell phone now from this country. So you have the two aspects of it in the mood of the nation. But if you ask me, my position has always been that those of us who were in Nigeria 50 years ago and I was there, we look back and we can say a lot has happened. A lot of good things have happened. God has blessed the nation. A lot of money has passed through the Nigerian government purse. Some of it got used well. A lot of it got stolen. But at the end of the day, if we compare ourselves with so many other nations, we should be able to say thank you to God at this occasion. That does not mean that we are satisfied with where we are. I definitely am one of those who believe that we could have done much better than we are doing now. That is a cause for us to rethink what we are, especially on the political level, so that we can move faster than we have done in the last 50 years.
Right, you talked there about some of those dissatisfactions, especially being expressed by the youth, of the failures of the past 50 years. Which are the ones which weigh most heavily on the country, in your opinion?
In my opinion, that which weighs most heavily on the country has been the fact that the nation has not had time to develop its democratic institutions in a consistent and progressive manner. We should not forget that of these 50 years, almost 30 of those years were spent on what we normally describe as military adventure. A whole nation being ruled by soldiers who succeeded one another by military coups, which meant that the building of democratic institutions did not get started in time. And even now, we are still more or less negatively affected by the influence of many of the top-level politicians who used to be military officers. So even Nigerians themselves are still trying to understand what it means to be ruled democratically. And if we were able to get that done and have free and fair elections and have people who would be responsible to the electorate and to the people, I believe that we have enough in the country to launch us beyond the third world stage.
Talking of elections, Nigeria, of course, is scheduled to have elections next year. But some people have expressed fears about the current power vacuum in the country in the lead up to this poll. I mean, do you share those fears that violence could break out?
I do not think violence will break out. What I'm afraid of is that once again, the small group of people will simply determine who will rule us. And Nigerians have learned to be rather patient in these matters. We have a professor of history who is now the chairman of the Electoral Commission. He has been saying the right things, but we are still waiting to see how he performs. Also because he's not the only one. He has to work with a commission that is made up of people appointed by the political party in power. So the whole question of having a free and impartial umpire has remained a challenge. And whether we are going to be lucky this time, whether the present president, Goodluck Jonathan, will make good his promise that he will ensure free and fair election, we have the next few months to find out. What is sure right now is that we are not on schedule at all. We are way behind. The electoral register is still not in order, which in itself is a shame because we knew 4 years ago that we are going to have an election this coming year. All this should have been settled, but they were not.
One of the problems that many people talk about when taking stock of the situation of Nigeria, particularly on this 50th anniversary of its independence, is corruption. How pervasive is it and how much does it impact on daily life?
The impact on daily life is tremendous. Simple reason that you have a country that is receiving millions of dollars of income every day from oil sales, and therefore we have more than enough resources to give the people of Nigeria a decent level of life. And by this, we are not asking for anything extravagant. We think that Nigeria ought to be able to organize itself such that children will go to school, that people who are sick can get cured in government hospitals with a minimum of good treatment, that the villages are put in a livable condition with simple amenities like roads, water, not to talk of electricity. Some factories that were flourishing 20 years ago are now dead. And we spend all our foreign exchange earnings buying up products that are produced by others, giving them our oil money, and keeping their young people in jobs that Nigerian young people should be doing in our own factories here. These are the issues that come out of corruption. It is not as if there is no money. It is that the money is being badly misplaced.
What about relations between Christians and Muslims? We've seen periodic flare-ups of violence. How important is the role of the church here in trying to improve intercommunal relations?
Well, I'm glad you said periodic because it is really periodic. And when I say periodic, I don't mean every week or every month. It's practically just about once or twice a year. It isn't as if we underestimate the importance of these occasional outbursts, but I do believe it should not be overflogged. Under normal circumstances, we are trying our best to work together. As for the role of the church, everybody knows that the Catholic Church, guided by our Catholic social doctrines and the position of our church since Vatican II in the terms of interreligious cooperation and dialogue, we are in the front line of reaching out to Muslims and our other neighbors. And I don't think that we have failed. We have made a lot of progress. It doesn't mean that there are no problems. And especially in case of dialogue, there's always two parties. Sometimes the Muslim side may not be prepared to take our hands of fellowship, but we continue to do our best. And I am confident that it is the right way to go.
Okay, finally, if we could sort of sum up, as it were, how do you see the future, the next 50 years for Nigeria? Are you cautiously optimistic or what?
I am cautiously optimistic because I think more and more people are really expressing their dissatisfaction with those factors that are pulling us back. And my hope is that we will find a peaceful way of putting aside our bad habits and hoping that a new generation of leaders will emerge who will then run affairs decently so that Nigeria can take her proper role, not only in Africa, but in our emerging global community.
I was speaking to Archbishop Onayekin of Abuja about Nigeria's 50th anniversary. In Pakistan, the waters are finally receding in many areas following the worst flooding in living memory. But the humanitarian emergency for the victims is still just as serious. At the height of the disaster, more than 20 million people were affected by the floods, which covered around one-fifth of Pakistan. Nearly 2 months later, many of the victims of these floods are still desperate for money to rebuild their homes and their livelihoods after everything they owned was destroyed by the floodwaters. Meanwhile, charities are warning that more than 100,000 children left homeless by the floods are in danger of dying because they simply do not have enough to eat. Robert Swetman, who works for the Catholic Development Agency CAFOD, has recently returned from a visit to Pakistan. And he spoke to me about the extent of the continuing humanitarian emergency there.
It's still very, very significant. Just picking up on one point, in fact, the waters haven't receded in some parts of Sindh. There is still quite significant flooding. So although it's true in the northern parts of Pakistan that the waters have now begun to recede, the south is still suffering from those floods. In terms of scale, the numbers quoted are over 20 million people are significantly affected, with something like 1.9 million homes have been destroyed or particularly badly damaged.
Now, what are the main needs right now? Is it presumably to rebuild the houses of the flood victims, or is it more basic still, like food and water that they need, and shelter, of course?
The immediate need is for that relief phase. So it's food, it's shelter, it's basic provisions. But as part of the whole process, we need to start thinking about the medium and long term, so providing shelter, particularly in the north where winter is going to be arriving in a month or two. We need to start thinking about making sure that there's provisions there for those households and communities.
Now, agriculture forms more than half of Pakistan's earnings. You know, how badly is the country going to be hit by these floods that ruined, of course, many crops? I mean, how long will it be before the country's agriculture can recover from this disaster?
I think that's very difficult to assess at this stage. We know that the area which has been flooded has been extremely large, and the numbers quoted are the size of England and Wales suffered from those floods. And much of that land was agricultural land, which means that crops have been lost, and particularly seeds have been lost as well, which have been stored up. How long it will take to recover is going to be difficult to assess. A lot depends on the success in meeting the planting season over the next couple of months. If seeds can be planted, then there will be some hope in the effect not being too dramatic, but the problem is very significant.
How did you find the mood of the people, or at least the people that you were able to meet in Pakistan, or people that have been in touch with flood victims? I mean, what did they say about how these people are coping? What are they saying about their feelings about the future?
I think it's interesting because in different parts of the country, there are different challenges. So in the north, often the people who were impacted by the floods moved maybe only 20, 30 miles away to be with other host families. So they're in family units. Whereas in the south, people often moved hundreds of miles into completely different communities. So they're completely isolated. So there's a real challenge there in trying to bring people back into their home environments and the communities that they know.
Now, what about the plight of the children who are always the most vulnerable in these natural disasters? According to a recent report from UNICEF, they say that more than 100,000 children who've been left homeless by these floods are in danger of dying because they're simply not getting enough to eat. You know, they were already perhaps weak before, and now, of course, they've been hit by illnesses like diarrhea, respiratory diseases and malaria.
Yes, and the numbers quoted on malaria in the last 3 weeks, about 170,000 cases of malaria have been identified. So I think you're absolutely right. That's why your earlier question about where the focus is, you know, it is on providing that food, it's providing medical care, it's trying to provide the basic support. And certainly CAFOD, working with our partners, are trying to do that in the communities that we're working. So we are indeed providing food provision, we're providing medical support in parts of Pakistan.
But aren't you worried, as memories fade of this disaster and new ones occur, that it's going to be increasingly difficult to keep perhaps the money flowing? As you say, the needs are so great.
Yes, I think you're right. You might be aware that the UN issued their revised Pakistan flood response plan just over a week ago, and they're estimating there's a need for $2 billion over the next 12 months to meet those needs. Now, so far, they've received 30% of that. So there is an immense amount of funding needed to just to keep the, the Pakistan population surviving, in a sense.
I was speaking to Robert Swetman of CAFOD, who recently returned from Pakistan. Scientists have warned that a massive solar flare in 2013 could cause global chaos by triggering power blackouts and wrecking satellite communications. The warning comes from NASA officials, who say a peak in the sun's magnetic energy cycle and the number of solar flares around 2013 could generate huge radiation levels. The resulting solar storm could cause a geomagnetic storm on Earth, knocking out electricity grids around the world and bringing much of normal life grinding to a halt. But just how real is this threat? And have modern societies become too dependent on technology that leaves them vulnerable to such events? I've been investigating with the help of astronomer Brother Guy Consolmagno from the Vatican Space Observatory.
The Sun has a very large magnetic field inside, and on a roughly 11-year cycle, these tend to form lots of sunspots for a while, and then it goes away and there are a few sunspots, and 11 years later they come back. When they make big sunspots, they also pour out lots of highly charged electrons and protons, which turn into what we call the solar wind, and so all of these highly charged particles go flying through space. If they run into a planet like Earth, then they can distort our magnetic field and change the way that our radio and electricity works here on Earth.
But why is this forecast space storm going to be a really big one? They're saying this is, some people are saying it's maybe a one in a generation type storm. So what's so special about this one?
Well, most of the time when the sun erupts, it erupts into a direction that the Earth is not in, so it misses us completely. There is some evidence for a storm or possibly two storms simultaneously occurring on the sun in a direction where it could encounter the Earth and it could create problems. We know in the past that, for instance, back at a solar maximum back in the 60s, the power grid in Quebec was knocked out for about a day because of the extra energy there. The really interesting thing that's new is that since the last solar maximum, we have adopted so much of our technology involving Wi-Fis and cellular telephones and a lot of other using the radio spectrum for ordinary day-to-day work. So we really don't know what the effect of a solar storm is going to be.
Nonetheless, there have been some, I would say, almost approaching rather doomsday scenarios being painted by some sectors of the media, particularly in Britain, saying that it could cause power cuts for long periods of time and across wide areas. I mean, how accurate are these forecasts?
Well, there was a prediction for such a storm in early August. Do you remember hearing anything about it? Of course not, because in fact, nothing like that actually happened. Everything is possible. Whether it's likely is another issue. I think at this point it's mostly a scientific curiosity, but you always have to keep in the back of your mind that, you know, some very unusual thing like that could occur. I mean, what were the odds that a volcano would stop traffic across the Atlantic for a couple of days? And yet, it does happen.
What can we do on Earth to try and, let's say, mitigate the effects of this or put in preventative measures? There are some kind of shields, I was reading.
I don't really know of any way that you can completely protect against it, because what you're changing is the actual nature in which our magnetic field and our ionosphere will conduct electromagnetic waves. And, you know, unless you can actually change the Earth, you can't fix that. The real answer, of course, is to be willing to wait it out and to have more than one way of communicating so we don't have all of our eggs in one basket.
Do you think in some ways we have now become too dependent on electronics, mobile phones, satellites, as you say, the internet, that we are left very vulnerable if for any reason electricity in particular is taken away from us or is cut?
There is a certain vulnerability there. Anyone who's lived in the third world that it has to experience regular electricity cuts, realizes how much we depend on it, but also that, you know, we were able to live without electricity in the past, and with a little bit of adaption and a little bit of flexibility, we can again. One of the wonderful things I do as a Jesuit brother is to take a week-long retreat where I turn off the computer, turn off the cell phone, and suddenly I can be closer in touch with God in prayer again.
Presumably, if there were, as a result of this solar storm, widespread power cuts and disruption to communications, there could be quite a severe economic impact, not to mention, of course, when it hits places like hospitals, you know, a life and death impact.
Most of the time in hospitals, they have their own independent power supplies, and they don't necessarily depend on this using wireless means to transmit. Anytime you're using, say, instead of using electricity or using Wi-Fi, you use these optical cables. In fact, we are in some ways more protected from these storms than we were 20 years ago when everything was still electric lines. So in some ways, we're more vulnerable. In other ways, we're less vulnerable.
Now, I read that these solar flares that they're predicting are coming after the sun has awoken from what has been called a deep slumber. What happens and what impact does it have on us when the sun is in a deep slumber, as it apparently is right now?
Yeah, as I said, there's an 11-year cycle that we've seen over time, but every now and then the sun doesn't exactly follow the calendar, and this solar minimum has been a little bit longer than traditionally we see. It's been a little bit more than 11 years. So as scientists, we're interested to try to understand why there's an 11-year cycle and what it's going to mean. The answer is, of course, we really don't know. The effect of the solar cycle does affect weather on Earth slightly. And ironically, sunspots, which are dark spots in the sun, tend to make the sun hotter on Earth because there's more energy coming around the edges. So it could be that the solar minimum has mitigated some of the worst effects of global warming.
And coming back to these solar flares, these solar storms, is there anything here that is visible by telescope?
You can see sunspots with a telescope that's equipped properly, but it's very dangerous to use a telescope to look directly at the sun. Anybody who's looked at an eclipse knows about this. But if you have very dark filters, special filters, you can see sunspots with the small telescope, but only with very special filters. You never want to look directly at the sun.
Now, presumably, given these warnings of this solar storm, are there a lot of scientists, of space scientists, who are studying this threat and finding out more things about it?
Oh, yes. There's a very active field of planetary science called solar weather, or space weather. And it's precisely understanding how the solar wind behaves and how these magnetic fields will travel from the sun to us. This field is only 50 years old. The entire idea of a solar wind was only proposed in 1958. So we're still learning ourselves.
I was talking to Brother Guy Consolmagno of the Vatican Space Observatory. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.